they are elected by you, I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
They didn't want one person, one man to have all the power like a king.
We show by our work that free people can govern themselves.
You can't pay lip service to the Constitution without obeying it.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc forum called Courthouse Steps Decision, Federal Communications Commission versus Consumers Research. We're very pleased to welcome our excellent speaker, Sean Lev, who is a partner at HWG. And special thanks to Devin Watkins for moderating this discussion today. Devin is an attorney at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speaker, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we may turn to the audience for questions. So if you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. And finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Devin, thanks so much for joining us today, and I will hand things over to you.
Oh, wonderful. And I want to note also, these are our views, not the views of our employer or our clients. My name is Devin Watkins. I'm a graduate from Scalia Law School, previously at the Cato Institute, and I represented the Competitive Enterprise Institute in an amicus brief filing in this case in support of respondents. My focus on this case is the original meaning and proper application of the non-delegation doctrine. I'm joined today by Sean Lev, an expert in administrative law in technology, telecom, and energy sectors. After graduating Harvard Law School and clerking on the DC Circuit, he's held many prestigious positions, including as the chief legal officer of both the FCC and the Department of Energy. He represented one of the petitioners in this case. Sean will start by explaining the case, what the court did, and his thoughts. I'll provide my thoughts on the case. We'll discuss amongst ourselves before taking audience questions. If you do have questions, please use the Q&A feature so we can answer your questions. With that, I'll turn it over to Sean to get us started.
Sure. Thank you, Devin, and thank you, Edith. So the issue in this case was whether, at a very high level, the FCC's Universal Service Fund and the scheme that is set out in 47 U.S.C. Section 254 violates what's known as the non-delegation doctrine. We can talk more about what that means. There's also a subsidiary issue of whether the delegation by the Federal Communications Commission to a private entity, a nonprofit known as the Universal Service Administrative Corporation, or USAC, violated any constitutional principles. The petitioners in the Fifth Circuit and in several have brought this case in several circuits. They brought one in the Fifth, one in the Sixth, and then one in the 11th. Essentially, what they did was challenge one of the quarterly assessments for interstate telecommunications carriers, how much they had to pay, claim those assessments should be zero because the universal service scheme was unconstitutional, and then challenge those for different quarters in different courts. Their challenges failed in both the Sixth and 11th Circuit. The challenge initially failed before a panel in the Fifth Circuit, then succeeded by one vote en banc in the Fifth Circuit, and the Supreme Court took cert. The federal government, the FCC, and the Solicitor General sought cert, as did our clients, which are the Schools, Health, and Libraries Broadband Coalition, and a variety of industry groups also sought cert. The court granted those petitions, consolidated them, and then in this case agreed with the petitioner's Supreme Court that there was no non-delegation violation here. Without going too far into the specific statutory scheme, the court applied what has been understood for roughly 100 years to be the non-delegation test, which is called the intelligible principle test, which means Congress can delegate policy and other judgments to an agency as long as it provides an intelligible principle for the agency to apply. And that's been applied to various relatively broad statutory standards, public interest standards, just and reasonable standards, and a variety of other ones discussed in the case. The court applied that standard here. The majority opinion was for six justices, written by Justice Kagan. She applied it fairly straightforwardly, found that as to both the services that could be supported under the Universal Service Fund and how much should be collected to support those services, the statute was sufficiently clear. We could talk more about the specific statutory language there, but I think a few just key takeaways on how the court went about this. First, as I said, the court applied the intelligible principle test, which there has been some controversy over, but has been the governing test since probably the J.W. Hampton case, which I think is 1928. The court also rejected the argument that petitioners below, respondents in this court, made that there's a different test if a tax or a fee is involved. The court cited two prior Supreme Court cases that had rejected that and stood by that determination. And I think also another significant aspect is the court, I think, read the statute fairly and consistently with how the agency and others have understood it in the 30 years since it's been passed, but also said, I think, reasonably enough, and this, I think, is a fundamental distinction between how the six justices and the majority and the three dissenting justices saw it, is that it should be read, to the extent there's any ambiguity, the Ashwander principle or constitutional avoidance principle suggests that you should choose the reading that does not create a constitutional problem. The court rejected as well I'm not going to go into it, the so-called private non-delegation doctrine argument, as well as an argument the Fifth Circuit had made that the combination of the two delegations, even if either was not independently a constitutional violation, together they did constitute a violation. There are two concurrences, a very brief concurrence by Justice Jackson, who took issue with the question of whether there is a private non-delegation doctrine. And then a more interesting or lengthy concurrence by Justice Kavanaugh, where he, I think, cited prior decisions from Chief Justice Rehnquist, Justice Scalia, and others, acknowledging that these are questions of degree and that the non-delegation doctrine does give sufficient leeway, significant leeway to Congress to call upon agencies to apply federal statutes. The three dissenting justices were Justice Gorsuch, Justice Alito, and Justice Thomas. Justice Gorsuch wrote the opinion. He disagreed with most of what I've said. I'm sure we'll have some opportunity to discuss a little bit of what he thought, but I think for now I'll turn it back over to Devin. Devin, feel free to fill in what I'm sure I missed in a fairly quick summary of a lengthy, both a complicated case and a complicated procedural issue.
No, I think you accurately described the result from the court. I want to focus more on my opinion of how the court did these things and what I thought about that. So the way I view this case, it really has to be considered in two parts. The first part is the statutory interpretation of the Communications Act, and the second part, how the court dealt with the non-delegation doctrine. It seemed very clear to me from the oral argument that the Democrat-appointed justices wanted to avoid the non-delegation doctrine as much as possible. And to do that, they were going to construe the delegated agency authority under the statute very narrowly. And because of the agency authority was so small, then they don't have to deal with some of the more difficult non-delegation questions. Now, under the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, judges can take ambiguous words and construe them in a way to be constitutional if there's multiple possible meanings. But there does come a point where that legal interpretation is no longer reasonable. And my fear is that the court in this case twisted the statutory meaning beyond the point where it would be a reasonable interpretation. And that's specifically in two ways. First, the statute authorizes the FCC to create a sufficient fee to pay for universal service. And the court interpreted sufficiently not only to create a floor of what the FCC could raise, but also to specify the maximum amount that the FCC could raise. This effectively eliminated the discretion of the FCC as to how much money to raise, but it seems like quite a stretch of the word sufficient to me. It seems strange to me to say that if the FCC raises too much money, that it's an insufficient amount. The second way is that the statute creates four factors that the FCC, quote, shall consider when deciding what kind of universal service there is that it's funding. And the court interpreted that requirement such that all of the factors are mandatory requirements, that it not only must consider them, but if any of them are violated, that it goes beyond the FCC's authority. This, again, eliminates agency discretion, but it seems like quite a stretch of the word consider to me. Turning to how the court dealt with the non-delegation doctrine, the modern non-delegation doctrine, I think, is fundamentally flawed. And I'm sad to see that a majority of the court wasn't willing to kind of fundamentally reconsider it like I think the dissent would have. My view is that the original meaning of the non-delegation doctrine is an application of the common law of agency as applied to the Constitution. Remember, at the founding, there was no body called constitutional law. There was no previous written constitution in a similar way. Instead, the most appropriate body of law was agency law. This covers when one person delegates power to their agent. And that's effectively what the Constitution does. It delegates the sovereign power from the American people to its agents and government. And the common law of agency has many rules that explain the scope of such delegated power. And one of those is a limit on subdelegation. Ministerial acts could be subdelegated, but discretionary acts could not be. Most factual findings, for instance, could be properly delegated to an agency, as those fall within ministerial acts. They lack the kind of policymaking discretion that's in the hands of Congress. And I think you see a lot of elements of this, both in the dissent and more specifically in Gorsuch's dissent in Gundy. But sadly, the majority in this case was not willing to go that far. While Alito and Thomas joined Gorsuch's dissent, Kavanaugh wrote a concurrence that makes very clear that he thinks it's entirely appropriate for there to be extensive policymaking based on what the law is within the executive branch. The majority opinion, however, while not revolutionizing the non-delegation doctrine like I'd like, did embrace the modern non-delegation doctrine and even strengthened it. I think this was, at least in my opinion, clearly at Chief Justice Roberts' discretion. He has a very kind of incremental style of judging where he avoids major changes in the law and tries and is even willing to accept like short-term losses to plant the seeds of a more long-term victory. And that's what this opinion seems to me to be. Non-delegation lost in this case, but the majority actually rejected the respondents' view of the non-delegation doctrine as not being aggressive enough. The respondents had argued that Congress could set a maximum tax rate and that the FCC could apply a lesser tax rate according to a standard set by Congress up to the maximum set by Congress. According to the majority, that would provide the FCC with too much discretion beyond what the non-delegation doctrine would allow. That's a rather aggressive view of the non-delegation doctrine that I'm rather shocked to see that the liberal justice is fully embracing. The court, I think, rejects properly the kind of combination theory that the Fifth Circuit had, where maybe the public non-delegation doctrine itself wasn't enough to invalidate the statute. Maybe the private non-delegation by itself wouldn't be enough, but put the two together and you get a constitutional violation. I'm actually with Justice Jackson on this, who cites Sasha to say that there is no such thing as a private non-delegation doctrine. Either the power has been improperly delegated to someone or it has not been. The proper challenge instead for me is an appointments clause challenge, as only officers of the United States can properly exercise federal sovereign power, or a due process clause challenge due to the kind of self-interest that the people involved had. They're kind of judging their own cause, as it were. Now, going forward, thinking about the implications of the non-delegation doctrine, Given the kind of backflips that the court seemed willing to do to limit agency discretion to avoid the non-delegation issue, it seems to me that the non-delegation doctrine is most likely to be applied as a rule of construction going forward rather than a bright line rule. This means that the non-delegation doctrine challenges will be brought alongside another statutory interpretation claim and create a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't problem for the agency. If the court interprets the agency discretion in a way that the agency wants, then you have a non-delegation doctrine problem. And therefore, the court should, under constitutional avoidance, interpret the statute more narrowly than the agency would like. This seems to me to be the most likely way to successfully use the non-delegation doctrine going forward. Now, this doesn't mean that the non-delegation doctrine has no effect, even if there's no statute that it overturns. Instead, it operates a lot more like how the court treats the 10th Amendment. The court calls it a truism that the federal government cannot act beyond its enumerated powers, in which one would think then it would have effectively no effect. But in actuality, there's a marker, there's a point at which the lines have gone too far and beyond the scope of the federal powers. And it effectively means that if you reach the point in your interpretation where the government, federal government has a kind of broad police power, you've gone too far. Likewise, for the non-delegation doctrine, when you've reached the point that the agency has unlimited discretion as to the law, then you have gone too far under the non-delegation doctrine. And instead, this will allow many statutes to be more narrowly construed than they would otherwise have done by the courts. Okay. So that's my thoughts, and I'll turn it back to Sean to see what he thoughts on my views and if he has any further thoughts on the court's interpretation.
Sure. And thanks. And that's interesting. I think some of it is more of sort of an academic view of a jurisprudential view that I'm probably not going to comment on. A few things about the actual case, though, that I think are worth noting and where we probably do part company. I don't think that the opinion stretches the statutory language at all. Actually, I think it's consistent. This is not a new statute. It's a statute that the FCC has been implementing for 30 years. And let me use one example. Devin referred to the fact that the collections, and without going into too much detail, that the collections have to be sufficient under Section 254. In fact, that word is used three separate times. And is it reasonable to understand sufficient to be a ceiling as well as a floor, to use your words, and I think the words the courts use. I don't think I can do better in, as in many, many other things than Justice Kagan in this regard. So I'm going to read a little bit from the majority opinion in their explanation of why sufficient was reasonably understood to provide a ceiling. He says, Justice Kagan says, if you told a friend to order a sufficient amount of food for five people and 500 boxes of pizza showed up at your house, you would not think he had followed instructions to provide a sufficient amount of food. And I think that's right. And I think that's a common understanding of the word sufficient, enough but not too much. It doesn't, to me, do any violence to the statutory language to read it that way. I do think that in the context of the statute, which clearly intended to impose some limitations on the amount of contributions that could be gained. They also have to be specific. They have to be non-discriminatory. The idea that sufficiency implies a ceiling as well as a floor, which is also how the FCC has previously understood it, strikes me as perfectly reasonable. I don't think there's much here to suggest that there's other than the statutory. I don't think it's right to say that the majority certainly suggested that a cap would not be the idea that if you just put a $5 trillion cap on the size of the fund, that somehow would solve any problem. But I think the point there was not that that was somehow insufficient or not aggressive enough. It was that the idea of that you need an objective standard to meet constitutional muster is really not by itself a very powerful idea, and it was suggesting why the argument made was not a persuasive one. Not that it was one that went too far, but that's one that was not analytically very satisfying. That didn't go far enough, excuse me, but that it wasn't an analytically satisfying argument. I will agree in one sense as to the statutory construction point you made. Well, two senses. First, there is a reference to, as a tiebreaker, you do look at constitutional avoidance. That's that is explicit in the majority opinion, and that's routine. That's not breaking new ground. It's routine in constitutional law generally and in prior non-delegation doctrine cases. So I don't think that's different. I do think that both the majority in citing Loper Bright and Justice Kavanaugh in his concurrence in referring to the major questions doctrine and to Loper Bright have suggested that there are other limitations on broad assertions of agency authority that are not non-delegation issues that serve somewhat similar purposes. And Devin referred earlier to Justice Gorsuch's dissent in Gundy. That was a point he had made there as well, that he actually backs away a little bit from that in his dissent here, suggesting that they may not be sufficient in all cases. I do think this statute has a lot of guardrails, and there's a lot of language that the court relied on, and it's beyond, I think, the scope of people's interest here to go into all the details of the statute. I don't think this was ever a very powerful non-delegation case. I think if the Fifth Circuit majority, to be frank, and the respondents, the petitioners of the Fifth Circuit, were driven to read the statute in very broad and sometimes, I think, outlandish ways to create an issue that didn't necessarily exist. And once you read the statute ordinarily, or especially if you read it with a constitutional avoidance lens, if there are ambiguities, the issues really don't go away. I don't think there are, they disappear. I'm not sure there are any real issues. I think that's why you had a six justice majority here, that there was a common sense reading of the statute that was not limited to the perhaps more progressive members of the court, that the Chief Justice, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Barrett were all comfortable with. It is a six justice majority, all of whom concurred fully in the majority opinion.
Okay. Normally we would start asking questions from the audience. There are no current questions from the audience. So I will encourage everyone, please use the Q&A feature to put questions in so that we can get your questions answered. But until we get some questions from the audience, I will ask some questions of my own. So you say, Sean, that this is not a very good case for the non-delegation doctrine. What kind of case would you think people should be looking for that would be a good non-delegation case if someone wanted to bring one in the future?
I'm not gonna take that hypothetical with all respect. I think, you know, we won this case. It's a big win, and I think we should have won this case. This was never under standard non-delegation law principles a strong case, I believe. It was, you know, even under some of the alternative tests that, as we argued, that Justice Gorsuch and others have advocated, it wasn't a strong case in our view. It is an important case, though, in the specific context of the Universal Service Program, which is an $8 billion a year program, which lots of rural Americans and low-income Americans and rural hospitals and public schools throughout the country and libraries throughout the country rely upon. And this takes away a lot of uncertainty as to that. And I think that's very important in both the context, in the specific context of telecommunications law, and the fact that I think the court understood that this is an important program that Congress had set forth and had set guidelines on that allowed it to evolve within certain parameters. I don't think cases like this would be a good case, put it that way.
Okay.
That's not really saying much.
So after this case, where do you see like the non-delegation doctrine developing? How is this going to change how lower courts deal with the non-delegation doctrine?
Well, I think it restates, if there was doubt, that the intelligible principle test, as it's been understood basically in prior cases, is the law, should be applied. And, you know, that'll depend on the facts of a specific case, but the test is pretty clear that is the governing standard. And so I think it removes whatever uncertainty there had been about that. But
We have a question from the audience. A recent statute where private organizations delegated enforcement powers to search, prosecute, and punish people with minimum oversight by the FTC. I suspect what they're asking there is that kind of case, something that would be a case which would be the kind of case that the non-delegation doctrine might be invoked to help limit agency power or, you know, if not strike down a statute.
Right. I don't know anything about that statute, so I'm not going to say anything. As this question is phrased, it strikes me as more of what would be thought of as a private non-delegation issue than a public one, but I don't know quite whether this is coming from the statute or coming from the FTC. So I really don't know enough about it to comment.
So personally, I don't think the private non-delegation doctrine is a doctrine in law. The court kind of approaches it as, you know, some people claim this to be a doctrine and they don't quite endorse it. And you see a concurrence by Justice Jackson that says this whole private non-delegation doctrine doesn't exist. Do you think that's a real like doctrine in law currently, or is this something that people have kind of made up?
You know, I'm going to answer that in a very narrow way, which is there are cases that they relied on, upon the Carter Cole and then the Sunshine Anthracite, or the pair of cases, that set forth some constitutional limitation, whether that's called non-delegation. That limitation was not violated here, as the, actually six justices said, and the dissent did not reach, so there's no real dispute on that. I think Justice Gorsuch was pretty clear that he, actually five justices in the sense that Justice Jackson joined the majority, so I guess. So to the extent there is a principle set out by those cases, it was not violated here, given the extensive oversight that the FCC engages in and the fact that the FCC actually sets the relevant contribution factor, which was the real question. So whether that's a correct constitutional principle or not, there are cases that were relied upon by the Fifth Circuit and that the Supreme Court applied here to find no violation.
Yeah, obviously, there are cases they cited, and those cases are real law, and they express principles, whether they're a part of the non-delegation or some so-called private non-delegation doctrine.
I think that's right. I don't think they're, I wouldn't think they're the same as the non-delegation doctrine. I think one of the, to go a little bit in the weeds of the case, to when the court addressed the combination theory, one of the things it made clear was that these two things are not the same, right? The Fifth Circuit had relied on the free enterprise case, which was limitations on the executive branch's authority, and two separate limitations that sort of went in the same direction. Here, what the court said, well, the reason why, I think correctly, those were so that whatever the limitations are on an agency delegating to a private entity are not of the same kind as the constitutional non-delegation from Congress of Article I authority.
Yeah, executive branches can obviously exercise executive power, which is different than what private individuals can do.
Right, and just that the two different, in free enterprise fund, the two different limitations sort of both functioned, limited the same entity in a way that was not the case of the two kinds of, so I don't think it's a, whatever else it is, it's not a species of the Article I non-delegation doctrine.
So another question from the audience, how do you think this affects the other regulatory agencies? So I think what he's asking here is, what are kind of the broader effects within the regulated community? Or do you think the other agencies are gonna kind of limit the scope of how broadly they claim their delegated authority is to try to avoid the non-delegation doctrine in the future based on this case, or otherwise expand their authority not being fearing the non-delegation doctrine?
So there are obviously, I don't think I'm saying anything newsworthy to say that there have been a variety of cases, some of which we've mentioned over the last 5 years. When Chevron gets overturned, the cases that rely on the major questions doctrine, whether those are right or wrong, those limit agency authority. In my mind, you know, whether this affects other agencies, I can't tell you unless show me the statute and I'll tell you whether there's an issue under that statute. I will say that it's been almost 90 years now since a non-delegation doctrine violation has been found. To the extent that agencies are worried about overly broad interpretations of statutes, I would think the doctrines they're worried about are the ones that are statutory interpretation doctrines, the ones we've talked about, I imagine, not this case.
Okay. Now, I had kind of expressed my own I don't know if it's idiosyncratic or not quite consistent with modern precedent of the non-delegation doctrine on where I kind of see the originalist foundations of it are, but it's still modern precedent that J.W. Hampton and the intelligible principle test is kind of the precedent. And I would even agree with that. I think J.W. Hansen was rightly decided. That was the kind of foundation of the modern intelligible principle test. But within that case, it specifically cites to one of the doctrines, one of the maxims of the common law of agency. Do you think that is right? Or do you think J.W. Hansen has been limited so that that part of the opinion is no longer valid? Or do you think it just isn't relevant anymore?
I think the intelligible principle test is as stated in this case and has been stated in many other cases. I don't read that as different from J.W. Hampton, but what is actually relevant, I think, it's, you know, as a practitioner, what's the test? And the test is as enunciated in this case, which I don't think is different than in meaningful ways than prior case. I think that's confirmed by this case.
Okay. What do you think the dissent would do? If the dissent had a majority, how do you think how do you see their view of the non-delegation doctrine?
Well, the case would have come out differently. Yes. But by definition, it's a dissent, right?
Yes.
So those justices believed, as I understand it, that because this was a tax and not a fee, that a special standard applies. They discussed for a long period of time why it's a tax and not a fee. The majority didn't get into that issue, largely because it said it does not matter, the same standard would apply in either event. And then determined that if understood that way, it would not pass muster. That would have created significant uncertainty in this particular program and may have had a lot of other effects. I'm grateful that the court didn't go that way and that six justices disagreed.
Okay. Let's see. There was a very interesting concurrence by Justice Kavanaugh, where he suggested that there would be a difference between a kind of independent agency and an executive branch agency in the scope of authority that could be delegated to that. What do you think Kavanaugh is doing there? Do you think this has any implications concerning Humphrey's executor and whether there will still be so-called independent agencies going forward under Justice Kavanaugh's view?
So it does appear that Humphrey's executor is an issue that the court is going to need to address in the next year. I'm not going to go beyond that to speculate as to what the court will or won't do. I do think that his opinion is interesting in another way, because it really is a very full, as you said, a full-throated defense of the understanding of the limits of non-delegation doctrine as a separate theory. And he wrote quite a bit about the history of that, how more conservative justices have consistently understood it that way, and sort of consistent with an understanding of judiciary humility.
Mm-hmm. One aspect of this was the private non-delegation part, but specifically the way this statute operates. The FCC created this private corporation. Then it asked the private corporation to kind of evaluate certain facts and propose a rate to the FCC. And then that rate gets adopted automatically in some way if the FCC doesn't step in to change it. The court kind of blessed this. Do you think I am describing the statutory framework correctly? And what does that have as implications for other ways that the agencies have interacted this way?
I'll refer you to the opinion. I think that's not a complete and a understanding of how this works in a variety of ways. First of all, there was a pre-1996 Hotel Communications Act history of another entity serving a similar function under the then universal service programs that existed. So it was not novel or unexpected. Also, it is actually the FCC, not the agency that, not the USAC, the private entity that proposes the regulation. And there are an enormous number of regulations that limit what USAC can do. It cannot decide novel questions. Any USAC decision gets appealed to the agency. As I said, the agency itself is the one that proposes the rate every month based on information provided by USAC. So I'll refer you to the opinion for all the limitations, but I don't think that's actually a complete understanding of the relationship between USAC and the FCC.
One other thing I saw mentioned, I don't know if it was mentioned in the opinion itself, but was about the creation of USAC. I didn't see anything in the statute itself talking about USAC. It seemed like the FCC kind of decided the way it wants to implement the statute is to create USAC, and that was kind of within the discretion of the agency. Is that usual that the agency would do those kind of actions, go create a private organization to go administer, help administer the statute in that way? Is there anything unusual about it not being mentioned in the statute when the agency takes that kind of action?
I think I'm going to, that's a potential issue in future litigation, so I'm going to stay away from that other than to say I think the FCC is on pretty firm ground.
Sure. Okay. I want to say again, we don't have any current questions from the audience. So if you have any questions, please use the Q&A feature. I would be happy to ask the questions that you might have about the opinion. So how do you think the lower courts are going to handle this going forward? Is this going to be wrapping up? Is there any future questions you think lower courts might consider, or is this case over? The Supreme Court has decided everything. I know that there might be future litigation about this, but I wasn't sure about this case on remand.
Yeah, I'm not going to speculate about
it. I'm going to speculate on that.
On what other parties are going to do or not do.
Got it.
No, it's not our, the petitioners in the Fifth Circuit, what they're going to do, I'm not going to guess.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens there if anything does happen. How do you think the FCC is going to handle this going forward? Does this bless their current standing, their current interpretation, their current practices? So they'll probably go forward doing the same kind of thing going forward? Or do you think they might expand their authority or expand the kind of things they consider to be universal services?
I'm not going to speculate about what the FCC will do. I will say that obviously there are policy questions that are raised here. I think what this case makes clear is that the FCC can appropriately decide those within the constitutional bounds. There may be other limits in particular cases. That'll depend a lot on what the FCC chooses to do and what the facts and law applicable to those cases are. It's hypothetical. I can't respond. Other than to say that, before and after this case, there were policy questions. This does remove a substantial amount of uncertainty, though, as to the lawfulness of the program and, the ability of many, many Americans to receive services on which almost all of us rely. Rural Americans who are hard to serve, lower income Americans, hospitals in rural areas that provide telehealth. These are important services that Congress intended to support and that have been, I think, understood to be very important by Congress for the last three decades and can now continue to go forward.
Yeah, no doubt about that. The history of this is very interesting. Originally, these were tightly controlled, and we had effectively AT&T as effectively a monopoly that got broken up at one point. But even before, after that, there was a lot of rate control for how AT&T and other businesses operated in this. And part of the deregulation is what it was the time period in which this Universal Service Fund was created. How much do you think that kind of history of the creation of the Universal Service Fund went into the court's interpretation of this specific statute?
Well, I think it's been understood. You're correct. I agree with you that one of the things that the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which is essentially what you're talking about without going into the details, was intended to move to a competitive structure and to move from implicit subsidies in rates to explicit subsidies of the kind we have now, because you couldn't, the implicit subsidies were would be inconsistent with a competitive market. I think that's well understood in this opinion and in prior judicial decisions in the language of the statute itself and the legislative history and in 3 decades of agency determinations. I would say as well, though, that the universal service mission of the FCC goes back to the original Communications Act, right, which states that in the very first paragraph that providing service to all Americans, and paraphrasing the actual phrase, but it has always been part of the FCC's mission. And what occurred here, and I think the court, and I refer you to the court's opinion again, understood was that this was a continuation in that respect of part of the FCC's mission in a new competitive environment. And while the environment had changed, and so that required changes in how you accomplish that mission remained and in some ways was expanded to include, for example, rural health care and schools and libraries.
I would also note that a lot of these telecommunication providers originally, they're viewed as kind of common carriers. And that, I think, also had some impact on how the court interprets this statute and both how the FCC oversees and regulates this industry. Would you say that also had some impact on how the court interpreted the statute?
I'm not sure. I don't see that in the opinion. Mm-hmm. Certainly, some of the cases they cite are prior federal regulatory cases of network industries. So that may be something there, but I don't see it in the language of the opinion.
All right.
If you have something you want to cite, I just don't recall seeing that reference in the language.
No, I wasn't specifically citing a specific part of the opinion. It felt like that was the way the courts were looking at what the FCC was doing, that, this had been a very tightly regulated industry. And when it switched over to be more competitive, that kind of history and requirement of common carrier seemed to invade the reasoning why we want these people in rural areas to still have access to services, where if it wasn't a common carrier, there would be differences in the marketplace.
I think that's in the text of the statute. The 254B expressly requires the agency to further those purposes. There are 6 statute enumerated purposes. The things you mentioned are clearly explicit in that enumeration. So I don't think there's any ambiguity that those are the goals mm-hmm. that Congress pretty clearly directed that. I think that is part of the opinion, that the court understood that direction to be pretty clear and pretty well understood with and not the kind of just go forth, with the lack of direction that might have created not location.
Yeah. So potentially without that kind of direction from Congress in the statute as to the goals of the FCC, in another statute, in another context, the court might read things a little differently, potentially?
I don't know that I would say that. I think it depends on the context of the statute.
Depends on the context.
The language and what the statute says and what the agency has done. I can't answer that in the abstract.
Understood. Well, I'm running out of questions here, and we still don't have any additional questions from the audience. So I'm probably going to leave it there and let people back a little early.
Great. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Sean for speaking with us today and to Devin for moderating. We're really grateful for your time and expertise on this decision today. Thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and other upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's FEDSOC.org FederalSocietyVirtualEvent.com/article I.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.